by focusing on the Hermetic corpus and alchemy, I've just gotten tired of talking about psychedelic drugs. Nevertheless.
Hey everyone, welcome to Into the Dark. A quick announcement before we get into the witchcraft. Radio Free Brooklyn right now, doing a Patreon campaign. If you want to give us some of your hard-earned dollars to help us keep the lights on and keep the witches in, go to patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn. I'll see you kids at the back end of the theme music for Into the Dark.
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All about you!
Men are heralds in the pompous, erotic world of the witch people.
Journalists with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Buddy, it is a sex thing deep down and everywhere else. Welcome to Into the Dark, the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We got a jam-packed show for you today. We're going to be talking about how ghosts interact with U.S. law. I'm playing my interview I did with a visiting professor at Yale about Renaissance theories of how people would have sex with demons that played a major role in the witchcraft trials of the 1600s. But before we get into all those wonderful things, I've got a few announcements for you in the form of witchcraft news. So this is our first show of the new season. They renewed us. Hooray. And also the first show after the election. I know a lot of people don't want to talk about it, and that's fine. It's a wound for a lot of folks. And, I feel like the best thing to do is to try your best to stay active, stay angry, and try to protect the people around you. And in that vein, Catland, which is a witchcraft supply store here in New York City, they've started a project. You may remember on my third episode, I interviewed one of the co-owners, Melissa Madara. So they're doing an open casting call right now, looking for witches and magicians who desire to take a stand against the racist, sexist, transphobic, and violent president-elect. Send us a brief description of your anti-Trump workings and rituals. 13 will be selected to be featured in our Witches Against Trump photo project, ritual, and celebration. So if that sounds like a thing you're interested in doing, you should email Catland Books at info@catlandbooks.com. Not sure if the deadline is on that, but they're working for Witches Against Trump, and I think that's a really important thing. In keeping with that, actually, I was contacted by someone who's doing an event at Catland Books. So if you are in the New York area and you want to get down with some good witchy business, there is an event being done by the astrologer Friedrich Steinman, and that's going to be on December 4th. Doors open at sunset, which is at 4:23 p.m. And the event is to teach people that tarot and astrology speak similar languages. They're not so different. And people attending the event will be taught how to read a chart and to do 3-card past, present, future spread with someone's astrology chart. So this might be the beginning of a series of workshops, not sure. And it's for people with a background in tarot who want to learn more about astrology. So if you deal with the cards, want to deal with the stars, you should check this out. So it's at 4:23 p.m., December 4th at Catland Books. Admission is $25. And that's going to be happening in Bushwick. So check that out if you're interested. And hopefully I'll be able to get this guy on the show sometime because he seems really cool. Cool. So onward with our more regularly scheduled witchy business. Someone sent in a very useful question, and that was, dear Into the Dark, what is the relationship between ghosts and the law. And, you know, I was really hoping that there would be a lot to talk about with this, because the law is important. The law affects all of us. And American power and authority has been related to ghosts in different ways for a long time. Abraham Lincoln held seances at the White House during the Civil War. There was a petition read on the floor of, I think, the U.S. House with thousands of signatures asking for funding to try to devise some kind of telegraph system into the land of the dead. But when it comes to ghosts and the law, there are essentially two cases that we need to talk about to feel like we're doing this right. And the first one is what's referred to as the Greenbrier Ghost. So in Greenbrier County in West Virginia, in 1897, so over 100 years ago, there was a woman who got married. So the woman was named Elva Zona Hester. And Elva Zona Hester married a sort of traveling vagabond type by the name of, and I'm not making any of this up, I just want to point that out. This is not, I don't make things up on this show, but in particular, this is going to sound much less believable than almost anything I've talked about thus far. But this is real. The man's name was Edward Stripling Trout Shoe. That happened. There were people who had a child, and they wanted to name him that. And they did. And Trout Shoe met Elva Zona Hester, and they got married. And a short time afterwards, a small boy that Mr. Trout Shoe sent to the house for an errand discovered his lady wife dead at the foot of the stairs, as though she had maybe fallen. And when a coroner came an hour later to examine the body, the husband, Mr. Trout Shoe, had already put it in bed, dressed it with a high collar in preparation for the funeral with a veil over her face. And as the doctor came to examine her, the husband was cradling her head and sobbing. And when he tried to do a close examination, he had a violent outburst of sorrow, apparently. And so the coroner fled without doing much of an examination, and later ruled that she had died as a result of maybe childbirth or something along those lines, because apparently he had been seeing her about, and I'm doing air quotes right now, women's troubles. End of air quotes. But after she was buried, her mother was visited in a dream by the ghost of this young woman, telling her that her husband had been cruel to her, had beaten her savagely, and had broken her neck, and that is how she had actually died. And having seen this dream vision, the mother was deeply insistent that the body be exhumed, and that this man be brought to trial for the murder he had committed. And an attorney general believed her, and they exhumed the body, and a coroner did an actual thorough investigation and found that her neck had been broken, that there were fingerprints on her neck. And so, in what year did we say this was? Oh, gracious. So, on June 22nd, 1897, this man was brought to trial for murder. And the primary witness was the mother. And although the judge advised the jury to discount the story of the ghost, they apparently didn't, because he was found guilty of murder. All because of a ghost. Which is pretty awesome, I think. The other major case that anyone interested in the relationship between ghosts and U.S. law that someone should pay attention to is one that happened in New York State fairly recently. So, This case occurred in, let's see here, let me check my notes, on July 18th, 1991, and the case was Jeffrey M. Stambovsky versus Helen Ackley and Ellis Realty. And for citation purposes, this is 169 AD 2D 254 572 NYS 2D 672 60 USLW 2070. And this appeared before the New York Supreme Court and then later an appellate court. Gonna keep playing that sound effect as long as we're talking about this. So basically what happened was there was a house in Acme, New York, that had been advertised as haunted by poltergeists. And after a while, the owner of the house decided to sell it to this person, Jeffrey M. Stambovsky, without telling him it was haunted. And the real estate company also didn't tell him it was haunted. But after he had put down a down payment of something north of $36,000, for this house, because real estate in New York is expensive, he found out. Not sure how. My guess would be he either read about it somewhere or he was attacked by ghosts. So he wanted to back out of the deal. Seems reasonable. So he sued to get out of the sale. And the first court that saw this said that the owner of the house was at fault for not telling him about the haunting. In the majority opinion, it was quoted as saying, having reported the ghost's presence in both a national publication and the local press, defendant is estopped to deny their existence, and as a matter of law, the house is haunted. I'm going to repeat that. A majority opinion in a case that went in the New York State Supreme Court in the last 30 years said, as a matter of law, the house is haunted. I love this state. But what they decided was that because New York law has a clause for caveat emptor, which is the fancy Latin way of saying buyer beware, it was his fault for not properly checking the house for ghosts. Though he then brought that up to an appellate court, and the appellate court overturned the ruling in favor of the buyer who wanted to back out, because their argument was that haunting is not the sort of thing that's easy to check on necessarily, so it is unreasonable to ask a potential buyer of a house to check it every nook and cranny for ghosts. So, knowing this, and knowing that this sort of law could be applied to many, if not all, of the 50 states, given that a haunted house falls under the legal category of stigmatized property, and a person must be warned if a house is indeed haunted. You may be wondering, into the dark, how do I keep my house from getting haunted, and how do I clear out ghosts if I think there are some? So I've been looking into this. And if you want to get rid of ghosts in your house, let's start and pretend for a moment. Let's talk, hypothetically, your house is haunted. What do you do? And, you know, step one is actually consider laying down the law in your house. Talk to the ghosts and say firmly, this is my house, you need to leave. And a lot of the sources I looked at said that this might actually, if step one, this might be the end of it. If you just tell them, go away, in a firm and serious voice, that could be enough. If it's not, there are another of other steps you can take. So a lot of people will burn a smudge. It's important when you're using a smudge to get every corner, every nook, every cranny of the house besmoked. You can also use a new white candle in every room to purify them spiritually. These have to be new candles. That's the one rule I kept coming up against. The candles have to be white and they have to be new. You can also put mirrors on your doors. Bear in mind, the mirrors have to face outwards. So put it on the front door facing the street. If you have it facing inwards, it may in fact trap that ghost. And I'm led to understand that a relatively benign haunting can turn angry if you trap it with a mirror facing the wrong way. So heads up, guys. And if you want to keep ghosts out, maybe you've pushed them out, maybe you don't have any yet, but you're concerned that this is a possibility, there are two substances you can use as spiritual barriers, sort of like the invisifence that people get dogs, except this is going to be very visible. And those two substances are sea salt, which is known for its ability to purify, so put that around the perimeter of any room or any house. And the other is red brick dust, which is said to be something that ghosts and spirits just can't cross. So, you know, do this after you've gotten the ghosts out of the house, after you've asserted your authority, or used the white candles, or used the mirrors or the smudge. There's also the traditional routes. And by traditional, I mean hire a priest. The Catholic Church requires each diocese to have an exorcist. Every single one of them. The identity of the exorcist is usually kept a secret. So you can't, like, look that person up. You'd have to go through the church. I haven't done a lot of research into whether they charge a fee or not. I assume they wouldn't, out of being a ostensibly charitable organization. But, yeah, if you think that's a problem, look into it. And if you need your house to be exorcised, you should contact Into the Dark at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. With your narrative of that haunting. Incidentally, if you have a question for our research department, feel free to submit that at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. That RFB is because you're listening to Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn right now. A station that allows us to have a forum for witchcraft, which is pretty swell. So, having covered ghosts and the law, that's the last one, I promise. It's time to move on to my interview with Professor Walter Stevens. Walter Stevens is a visiting professor at Yale University right now, so I went up to New Haven, Connecticut, and met him at his room in the Quinnipiac Club up there, and talked about the subject of his book, Demon Lovers, Witchcraft, Sex, and the Crisis of Belief. And in this book, which is a fantastic read, if you're interested at all in the history of witchcraft theory, witch-related theology, witchcraft trials, the Malleus Malefactum, or Maleficarum, Maleficium? The Malleus. If you're interested in these topics, you couldn't find a better source. This is really fantastic work about a lot of the sort of classic witchcraft narratives, riding a broomstick, stealing penises and putting them in a nest in a tree, cursing cattle, and what would happen during witchcraft trials in different parts of Europe. There was actually a very big distinction between what was happening in continental Europe, especially Germany, where there was torture permissible because they were operating under a version of Roman law, and England, where that was not permissible, except they did find sort of ways around it where, like, I mean, if you're trying to find a witch's spot, which is supposedly the spot on a witch's body that is impervious to pain and does not bleed when pricked, that does mean poking someone with a needle a bunch of times. So that does sound pretty nasty. But we had a lovely chat about witchcraft theory, and specifically the notion that was used by the church to say that part of becoming a witch was you had to have sex with a demon. And it was really great talking to him, so I'm just going to play that interview right now. And I'll see you guys on the other side. Enjoy. So, thanks for
agreeing to meet with me. Let's get into it. So, the book, Demon Lovers, you examine the potential motivations behind the witchcraft trials of the Renaissance. And just to give people a better sense of the background of this, what kind of... So most of these witchcraft trials would have a sort of forced confession in them.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things were interrogators or inquisitors looking for in these confessions?
Well, that varies over time, but I would say if you take them as a whole over the whole 300-year span, what they were looking for was evidence of actual physical, verifiable collaboration between human beings and demons. And what this led to were some truly bizarre accusations that defendants were required to confess to. Most spectacular being the one that I chose for the title of the book, the idea that humans and demons actually copulated with each other.
And this came to be part of the definition of witchcraft that people were using at the time, right?
Right. By about 1450, it is becoming quite common. And it's a leftover from times when such accusations were being made against heretics. And so between about 1420 and 1460, more or less, you're getting a bleed over from what are very clearly heresy trials to what are looking increasingly like the witchcraft trials that we see in the 1470s and 80s and on into the 16th century.
And so your book makes the argument that this was the result of an internalized skepticism within, or am I misstating?
No, you're not. Put it this way, it is, I think, the result of a kind of crisis in the ease of belief in the tenets of Christianity. In other words, what we know about the early to late 15th century is that there were all sorts of crises going on. And we can see evidence of the psychological impact of these crises all over the place. And one of the most clear aspects of this impact is expressions of what I call resistance to skepticism. In other words, denunciations of people who are skeptical about religion, flamboyant protestations of belief in the articles of faith, and so on, and a kind of overall overcompensation on the part of the people who were in charge of constructing the idea of the demon-worshipping witch.
So when you point to figures who were in charge of constructing this notion, like who in particular stands out? Because, I mean, in the book you spend a lot of time with Heinrich Kramer's Malleus Maleficarum, and you make a really nice argument about how that's sort of been misinterpreted by a number of scholars since then because it was mistranslated.
Yeah, that is increasingly not a problem now that we have a fine new translation of the Malleus with all sorts of scholarly apparatus. But there were some key mistranslations in the old Montague Summers edition, which was, still is, published by Dover Press. But the point about witchcraft is that we have a clash of two different kinds of belief or structure in the late Middle Ages. Among common people who were, for the most part, unable to read anything, the idea of the witch was of a person who had within himself, or more frequently herself, some sort of magical power to do harm. And that power came from within the witch. It might be reinforced somehow by certain kinds of ceremonies or chants or whatever, but it was definitely something from inside the witch. Now, for 1,000 years, the church had ridiculed this belief. saying that it was simply the superstitions of ignorant common people. The church, when I say the church, what I mean in general is men who could read Latin and who had degrees in either canon law or civil law or theology. So in other words, we have two different ideas of what witches were. On the one hand, you have the village model, which is that there's a person who has this power in herself who can harm you, and that you may be able to pacify in some way by negotiation, among other things.
Right.
Now, as I say, that idea that there were powers of human beings that could be used to harm other human beings had been ridiculed by the church for most of the previous 1,000 years. What happens in the 15th century is that after the calamities of the previous century, and by this I mean the entire 14th century, the 1300s, after the calamities of the 1300s, you get a number of churchmen, particularly churchmen, who begin rethinking the idea of witchcraft. And they know from previous tradition, and know might have scare quotes here, but they know from previous tradition that human beings do not possess this kind of power. The only way that this kind of power can be produced, according to texts that are in the Bible, such as the book of Job, is through demons. Okay? Demons must somehow be lending their powers to human beings and giving humans the power to harm other human beings. Well, it turns out that in a world that seems to be falling apart, conspiracy theories, as always, are tremendously appealing. And so a number of Latin reading men begin hypothesizing that there is a kind of pact between certain malevolent human beings and demons, the object of which is to create an organization that is the inversion and the perversion and the turning inside out and upside down of Christianity. What this does for many of these guys is explain why everything seems to be going wrong. And this has to do with everything from the social sphere into the sacramental sphere, into, in other words, the rituals and beliefs of the Catholic Church, which at this time is still the Church rather than the Catholic Church. And so as these men go back over the disasters of their age, and we're talking about things like the Hundred Years' War, we're talking about the Black Plague of 1348, which in fact lasted for decades and kept coming back, killed a third to a half of the population of Europe. They see all of these things happening, and they begin wondering, you know, how can this be in a world ruled by a benevolent, omnipotent God? How can this be? One of the texts that they most love is the book of Job, because in the book of Job, the devil convinces God to test humanity, and the devil persecutes Job almost to extinction. And by about 1425, 1430, you're beginning to get meetings, actual physical meetings, of some of the men who will go on to create the early, what I call, theory of witchcraft. In other words, the fact that the devil and his minions are creating a conspiracy with certain human beings to harm Christians and overthrow the church. One of the most clear venues for this is the Council of Constance in the 1420s, which met in order to counter the perceived threat of the Hussite heresy. The Hussite heresy was a kind of proto-Protestantism that had been going on since the turn of the 15th century, and even before, in Bohemia, but also in a related way in England among the Lollards and so on. So you have these mass groups of heretics with their own doctrines. And they're meeting secretly, as they have to, because they are being persecuted by the church. Or, if not, they're in out-of-the-way places, like the area around Prague and so on, which is peripheral in some senses to what's going on in the more western parts of Europe. So you have men coming together, particularly at the Council of Constance, who actually turn out to write some of the early treatises in which this theory gradually gets put together. Now, Roman law makes it possible to torture, and the rules for torture get modified and carried on to such an extent that it is possible to torture people, to extract confessions from them, to essentially anything, but particularly to person-to-person and even body-to-body contact between demons and humans. Okay. The exception that proves the rule in this is England, where for most of the time in England, except for a period during the English Civil War, it is not legal to torture people. It happens, but much less frequently than elsewhere. And what torture does is allow the inquisitor, and let's use a small I rather than a large I because it's not only churchmen, but it allows the questioner to force the defendant into admitting this kind of person-to-person, body-to-body contact with demons. Now, the forms that this contact takes are most famously flying.
Okay.
All right? Now, witches being people, according to this doctrine, can't fly. Why are they so often pictured on broomsticks or animals or benches or hay forks, that sort of thing? Because they're being carried by demons.
Transvection, right?
Transvection or transportation. And so by being carried to the sabbat, the anti-church of the witches, as we might call it, they are confessing to having had bodily contact with demons. There's a problem, of course, in that demons have been defined at least since the time of Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century as purely spiritual beings, beings that have no bodies. So this leads to two of the more bizarre accusations leveled against witches. Not only flying, but even more, shall we say, dramatically, having sex with demons. The question, of course, is that the same men who are making people confess to having sex with demons also profess to believe that demons are pure spirit and have no bodies. How do they do this? They do this by hypothesizing that demons can create artificial bodies. They create them by compressing vapors and airs into a form that could fool you or me into believing that we were interacting with a real human being.
Right.
That body is then capable of having sex with a human being. Not only sex, but also conception, fertilization.
So, I'm led to understand that was that only... So they could not produce semen themselves, these bodies. They had to...
Absolutely. The idea behind this is that the demons, being purely spiritual creatures and having created these bodies that are essentially mannequins out of air, can't actually generate. How do they do it? Well, a demon would, according to this theory, first of all, take on the form of a woman and have sex with a man. And so the woman-shaped demon would be called a succubus. Not being hampered by having a real body, the demon could then, and did then, according to this theory, instantly transform that female body into a male body, and then carry that semen, stolen from the real male, to a real female woman, and inject it into her, and thereby create children. It seems crazy, and it seems that serious theologians could not have believed such stuff. In point of fact, the theory goes back to Thomas Aquinas again, and as happens with many of the theories of witchcraft, it goes back to Thomas Aquinas. Not that Thomas Aquinas believed the things that were attributed to him in the 15th century, but that things that he said about demons and their possibilities and potentialities were available to 15th century thinkers to put together in such a way as to explain to themselves how there could be verifiable bodily contact between human beings and demons. Aquinas, as I say, had not been worried about this stuff. He brought up the idea of demonically sired children simply in a kind of tail end of one of his many treatises on demons and their, shall we say, their natural history, their bodies and their behavior and so on. He brought up the idea in answer to his own question, how common people could have come up with the idea that certain figures, such as Merlin and some others that could be named, how certain figures were known as children of the devil. And so Aquinas, just for the sake of completeness in what's already a long treatise, says, well, this is how it would happen if such a thing happens. When you get down to the 1320s, 30s, 40s, and this idea of demonic witches is coming to a head, those theories are tremendously appealing. They show how the kind of contact that has always been hypothesized of heretics and demons could actually happen. And if you can get confessions to it, you then have a demonstration of how the world can have gone so badly wrong.
We've talked a lot about the ways in which witchcraft theory was based on logic that had been sort of established centuries earlier that would not really been intended for this, but clearly there was enough internal skepticism that this sort of like logical activity wasn't quite enough to convince even possibly the Inquisitors of it. So like, I feel like Pico, who we've discussed, he helps bridge that gap from logic to narrative-style evidence.
Right. From logic to narrative-style evidence and also to action. Gianfrancesco Pico della Mirandola was the prince of a small principate, a small state in northeastern Italy in the early 16th century. And he was actually the secular authority in charge of an area in which a Dominican inquisitor sentenced to death and actually had Gianfrancesco's legal mechanisms put to death 10 so-called witches, 7 men and 3 women. Gianfrancesco Pico is an interesting example because he takes the whole phenomenon of witchcraft from the merest exercise in logic, all the way down to the execution of a human being. And he does this in a number of stages. He was the nephew of another famous philosopher named Pico, who hypothesized all sorts of consonances between Christianity and pre-Christian beliefs, pagan beliefs. Gianfrancesco Pico himself was an avid follower of Savonarola, the great reformer and rabble-rouser of Florence in the late 15th century. And so he was having none of this idea that pagan beliefs, and particularly pagan philosophy, could have any common ground with Christianity. So we can follow his trajectory from an expression of doubt about the reality of witchcraft around the year 1500 to an enormous logical treatise, several hundred pages, in which he denounces all philosophy, and particularly Aristotelian philosophy, which was the main thread in his time, denounces all philosophy as inimical to Christian truth, and says essentially, throw away your philosophy books and go back and believe the Bible word for word. That's his position in 1520. Suddenly, in 1522 and 1523, we find him in the middle of a spate of witchcraft trials, for which he is the ultimate secular authority. What does he do? He writes a little book called The Witch, in Latin. It is laid out as a dialogue among four characters. There's an inquisitor. There is a philosopher who believes in witchcraft and Christianity. And there's a philosopher who claims to be a Christian, but also not to believe in witchcraft. And so these three men are having an argument about the reality of witchcraft, an argument which has been going on since the early 15th century, and to some extent since the middle of the 14th century. So the three men are having this discussion, but there's another interlocutor. There's a condemned witch herself. And the three men treat the witch as a kind of privileged informant on the reality of witchcraft.
Kind of like an expert witness.
She is an expert witness in the technical sense that had already been defined by the Malleus Maleficarum. So she's an expert witness, not to the reality of her own crimes, although that is important, but most particularly to the reality of witchcraft itself, which she confesses to having performed. Witchcraft itself, capital W, capital I, is in fact nothing more nor less than intimate physical contact with demons leading to a desire to overthrow the church. So the witch is cornered, although it's done very genteelly here by its apologist, rather than roughly as it would have been in an actual trial. She is maneuvered into a number of confessions. One, that she had a demonic familiar whose body was so lifelike and so real that she really didn't understand that he was anything other than either a man or a god, according to her. Second thing, that he constantly carried her to the witch's Sabbath, where all sorts of abominable crimes took place. And he did so by putting her on a kind of a little bench that was used in the processing of flax for cloth, and carried her over mountains and all over the place to these remote places where the Sabbat took place. Third admission, she had sex repeatedly with this embodied demon. One of the key questions in the dialogue is, how did you know that this experience was real? And she says, because I touched the body of that demon with these very hands. So if the experience is bodily, it must be real. Okay. Sex as the ultimate bodily experience is the ultimate guarantor of the reality. One of the early witchcraft theorists says, in parentheses at a certain point, it is impossible to have sex in your sleep. So this clearly shows that these are real experiences. Okay, the witch then has proved to the satisfaction of these three men that demons are real. They interfere in the lives of human beings. They are out to overthrow the church. And the sad mess that the world is in at the moment is due precisely to this conspiracy of demons and humans. Along the way, the witch demonstrates the absolute reality of the Catholic sacraments. In other words, she proves most spectacularly that when the priest says the words, "This is my body," over the Eucharistic bread, it actually turns into the body of Christ. How does she do this? Well, like as witches were commonly accused of doing, she's always carrying around consecrated hosts in her seams of her skirt. At a certain point, she begins to believe that these are not protecting her from the Inquisitor, because he's got her in jail, he's torturing her, and so on. And so she takes them out and throws them into her chamber pot and breaks them up with a stick. And then reports to the three men who are questioning her on the horror with which she observed these consecrated hosts, the crucified body of Christ, bleeding in her chamber pot. This partakes of a long tradition of answering repressed and sometimes not so repressed skepticism about the reality of the Catholic sacraments, particularly marriage, Eucharist, and baptism. Okay? Eucharist, we just saw. Marriage. What is the problem with marriage? The problem with marriage is that it is a sacrament too. And it is a sacrament because in the Bible, God says on two occasions, be fruitful and multiply. And therefore, since, to use the words of Aquinas, this is a work of God, how can it not happen? If people are legitimately married, according to God's words in the Bible, how can it happen that the man is impotent or the woman is sterile or any combination of factors that can lead to not having children, to not being fruitful and multiplying? Here again, Aquinas comes to the rescue, not realizing how many cans of worms he's opening up. He says, look, sacraments are works of God. That's right. Among the works of God, some are more powerful than others. The devil himself is a work of God. Therefore, the devil can be more powerful than the sacrament of marriage. And the devil can cause a man to be impotent with his wife and yet desire children with other women, can cause a woman to be sterile, the whole nine yards. Okay? Now again, Aquinas is just interested in the logic of this. But once worried clerics in the 15th century get hold of this logic, they start setting out to demonstrate it empirically. And the trial of witches is one of the ways in which, partly unconsciously, but I'm convinced also consciously, because I know of several cases, the activities of witches are taken as confirmation of the reality of demons, the reality of the sacraments, and in sum, the reality of the entire Christian project. So I think the upshot of all this is that witchcraft trials and the whole mythology of the witch's Sabbath that grew up in the 15th century and the whole mythology of intimate physical contact, including sex, between demons and human beings, was prized as a definitive, almost empirical proof of the reality of demons, the reality of contact between demons and humans, and therefore the reality of the church's sacraments and doctrines that witches and demons together were rendering either neutral or neutralizing or somehow inverting. All right. One of the things that's most notable about the so-called power of witchcraft given to witches by demons is that it is hypothesized several times by these thinkers as an inversion of the polarity, so to speak, of the power of the sacraments. All right. So the idea that some Protestants put about in the early Protestant period that the Catholic sacraments were magic actually relates to this whole idea that magic and the sacraments were thought about among late medieval Catholics as having real power, but real power whose polarities were reversed from one phenomenon to the next. So altogether, the whole mythology of witchcraft was an exercise in constructing belief in the reality of demons, the reality of the world of spirit, and therefore the reality of the whole Christian theological construct, right down to and including God himself. In the 18th century, once witchcraft had been completely disproved to most people's satisfaction, most reading people's satisfaction, John Wesley and other people whom we might qualify as fundamentalists in some sense, John Wesley said in his diary in, I think it's 1765, somewhere along in there, says, the giving up of witchcraft is the giving up of the Bible. And if you give up the Bible, you have to give up your entire belief in the reality of the spirit world, right down to and including demons, the human soul, and God himself. So ultimately, this repressed or semi-repressed involuntary skepticism about the reality of Christian doctrine was put under pressure in such a way as to require some sort of dramatic proof that it was actually real. And witches and demons filled that function in the problematics of this whole crisis in the worldview of medieval, late medieval Christian thinking.
Thank you so much for talking with me about this.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I always love talking about this stuff and can't shut up about it.
Well, I'm glad you've had so much to say. This has been fantastic. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Big thanks to Professor Walter Stevens for being on the program. That was a lovely conversation that we had. And if you want to learn more about this, you really need to check out his book, Demon Lovers, Witchcraft, Sex, and the Crisis of Belief, from the University of Chicago Press. I'll put a link up for it in the description of the show, but it's you can't find, I think, a better source for information about witchcraft trials and witchcraft theory. He told me as I was sort of leaving that interview that he's also working on a translation of that book he mentioned about halfway through the interview. Pico wrote about the witch, or the La Strega, I think it was called. in Latin. He's doing a translation of it right now, so that should be coming out hopefully in a couple years. And that'd be, I'm excited to check that right out, because that's going to be a sort of complex, well-annotated scholarly work. So I am, and as a huge nerd, I am deeply pleased. So we're coming up on the end of the show, and it occurred to me that since we were having some technical difficulties in terms of the volume, I was wondering if maybe you guys missed, every time I mentioned the law, this sound would happen. Just want you to know that that was going on, because it's good. So we're near the end. By the way, the end of Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you want to give us some money to keep the lights on, you should go to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. And you should check us out next month when we're going to be on the 18th, because we have moved to the third Sunday of every month. And before we leave, though, it's been a stressful time, I think, for everybody in this great nation state of ours. And we just have to be there for each other and protect one another as much as we can. Find ways you can be good to the people around you, but you also have to take care of yourself. And so I have a healing spell here that you can use if you want to feel a little better about things. It's in Latin, so take a moment and repeat after me. Tui gratia lovis gratia sit cures. One more time, that's tui gratia lovis gratia sit cures. Whenever you're feeling drained out, look in the mirror and say that. Feel a little better. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. Check us out next month. And if you have any questions, by all means, send them to intothedarkrfb@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter. We've got a Twitter now. Have a good night, guys. Thanks for listening.